If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. All right, what do we got going on? Let's start with, well, no, we'll end. Okay, we'll start with it. It's comedy, but it's sad. Joe Flaherty, SCTV, passes away, age of 82. We're going to talk to Bill Brio about that coming up a little later on. Joe Flaherty, I think the only American in the group, and was actually one of the founding key figures who brought the troupe, the Second City Troupe, which I believe originally was in Chicago, to Canada, to Toronto, and then evolved into the TV show, and the rest is history, as they say. Joe Flaherty passing away. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, I don't know, and we talked about this the other day, the Justin Trudeau pre-budget roadside distraction tour, it continues. And, you know, I was talking about this to experts on Friday, and they were kind of skeptical. Oh, you're reading too much into this, Scott. But, you know, it's just so funny that instead of having the budget come down on April 16th, every single day, the Prime Minister is going to announce something to do with the budget. Before the holiday, it was, what the hell was it? Oh, rental in your rental. You get credit for your credit score or something, and a renter bill of rights, school food program today, and just, you know, bing, bang, boom, all it, you just keep churning it out. And he's going to do this right up until the election, the budget. Wouldn't it be nice if there's an election then? And you know, instead of announcing it all at once in one sort of boring brouhaha, he's doing it a story, a topic a day, which will, you know, of course, give him, get him some coverage. Whether that changes anything, I'm not sure. Because many people are just asking, well, why now? And on the other hand, why not just vote for the NDP? Because, you know, he's taken the once center left liberals down the socialism laneway. Why not just vote for the NDP? But anyway, that's the way it is. And today's rollout is a food program. So, yeah, I'm sure you'll hear lots about that on the news and billions of dollars for that. But then again, like other stuff, it's just pushed off onto the provinces. And if they don't buy in, if those conservative premiers don't buy in, how many are there? One or two or seven? How many? One liberal. There you go. So again, the rest are NDP. Why not just vote for them, I guess, if you're looking for your left alternative? So, and you know, what really annoys me about this prime minister is that he creates a problem and then comes in to save the day with some sort of solution. And it's just happened time and time and time again with various departments, whether it's housing, whether it's immigration, whether it's healthcare, whatever it is. It's just like it's just one thing after another, one thing after another. But we're supposed to buy in on the carbon tax and his mission to save the planet. None of the other stuff works, but we're supposed to. This does work. This does work, even though none of the other stuff does. But, you know, here's the headline today, and it's on our global website. Trudeau says temporary immigration needs to be brought under control. Well, as I've said on the show for the last couple of weeks, it was 2 years ago, the immigration department said that to him. Like, post-pandemic, you're bringing way too many people into the country, over 1 million people a year. That's a city the size of Ottawa. I don't have to tell you what the housing starts are. So, again, when you've got systems that are stressed already in a post-pandemic world, whether it's healthcare, whether it's housing, whether it's affordability, whatever, you add more people to the problem, you're going to stress the systems even more. And, you know, again, the immigration department said because economic policy for the prime minister was more immigration. That was his economic policy. Didn't see a business case for Canadian liquid natural gas, but does for this. So, and he was warned a couple of years ago, don't do this, by the immigration department. The minister of immigration now is the housing minister, Fraser, which seems quite odd as well. You know, doesn't listen, but now is building the houses to get them out of it. So the prime minister says that the government wants to rein in the number of temporary immigrant workers coming to the country, saying the situation has to be brought under control. Well, how did it get out of control? Because you let it get that way. And as the Auditor General says on the ArriveCan app, it's a lack of management. And how many times do we have to bang this drum? And here it is here. You know, he opened the floodgates for international students, then caps it. Opens the floodgates for temporary residents, and then caps that. And now says whether it's temporary foreign workers or whether it's international students in particular, I'm quoting, that have grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. Well, you were told that. And then he gives examples. That's something we need to get back under control. Well, like everything else, it's out of control because of him. Seriously. And I don't know how much, you know, and now they're doubling down on the carbon tax and selling and all that. And we got all these experts over here that say this. And, you know, I mean, so none of this other stuff works with the carbon tax. We got that figured out. And you got to believe us on that. And they wonder why there's a lack of trust. It's just insane when you think about it. Sad news over the weekend. We hear that it's interesting. You know, I think of Joe Flaherty. I immediately think of Second City. When, of course, Major Tom thinks of Joe Flaherty, he thinks of Freaks and Geeks. It's amazing how long and how far this man's career spanned the comedy spectrum from the day he started till his last days. Bill Brio with his TV critic and author here now. Bill, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing fine, Scott. How are you?
Thanks so much, Bill, for joining us. Much appreciated. Your thoughts on, let's talk about the early stages. How instrumental was he in the Canadian version of SCTV? And I believe coming from Chicago?
I think it was Pittsburgh, but yeah, from the States. And yeah, he was
but I think he was born in Pittsburgh, but wasn't the Second City troupe, didn't that start in Chicago?
You're absolutely right, Scott.
Yes, yeah.
Absolutely. So yeah, he had that Second City experience first, and when he was setting up the writing room for SCTV, he was the guy in the big chair for a lot of it, and so he really did shape the show very much. You know, he and his brother were both writers on the show, he was so strong in terms of the comedy as characters. You know, when you think of SCTV, we think Joe Flaherty is Sam. We're all on the Sammy Maudlin show today, right?
Yeah.
Sammy Maudlin, William B. Williams, they're both gone now. Floyd Robertson, of course, the news anchor, was also Count Floyd. We all ran around going, for 20 years there. Guy Caballero, who ran the station, and even one of my favorites, an early character, Alky Stereopoulos, who was generally drunk. But he kept popping up in everything you loved, like Freaks and Geeks, or he was in Stripes for 3 minutes. You know, he just was a welcome note of joy wherever he came.
And had longevity as a result of that, maybe because he wore several hats.
He did, but also I think that the comedy generation that were inspired by him or came up, you know, Judd Apatow, he just grew up a huge fan of Joe Flaherty and had him on Freaks and Geeks. And he did a lot of animated voiceovers on shows. You know, he was on Maniac Mansion here in Toronto, Hamilton for a while. He's just a welcome note of comedy. And I ran into him once at an airport. I might have been LAX. We were both waiting for our bags. And I thought, oh, my God, it's Guy Caballero. And he was just so nice and kind. And we talked about Alky, and he was happy it wasn't Count Floyd. And just a real sad day.
So how did he get to SCTV? What was he? Was he a stand-up? How did he get there? Because he was also, like you said, sitting in the head chair in the writer's room.
From what I understand, it was more from his development with, improv comedy. I don't think he was a stand-up. Could be wrong. But I think it was mainly from that Chicago Second City Association.
Right.
That's where he learned to write. In later years, about 3 years ago, he got into some trouble because You know, we're all waiting for this Martin Scorsese great documentary about SCTV. And it had been a few years. There was a taping at Toronto. Jimmy Kimmel came in to moderate, and they were all sitting there. And then it went quiet. And all of a sudden, Flaherty, I guess, was sort of getting on social media. And he tweeted that he'd heard from Dave, and the thing was off, and Scorsese's lost interest or something. And people went crazy. There was all the denials and no. Joe doesn't quite learn his social media stuff yet. So I think he got his wrist spanked. But here we are 3 years later, and there's still no word about this documentary.
So would his death have any bearing on any of that moving forward?
I just hope they do it before they're all dead. You know, like, what are they waiting for? So I don't know. It's going to be odd. But I was there that night and I saw them all on the stage, and it was like Lourdes, you know, it was like high mass for comedy. It was just a room packed with comedy geniuses, and certainly Flaherty at right near the head of the table, although they were John Candy. I mean, those two really just tremendous.
You know, it's hard to believe when as a kid I'm watching this show and it's, you know, Wendy O. Williams of the Plasmatics doing outside shots with a chainsaw and no top. What was that segment called with John Candy?
Fish and Magician.
Exactly. And who would have thunk that watching that, it would have evolved into what all of these people ended up becoming? It's pretty funny because it was very off center back then.
It was so personal and eccentric and specific. They were goofing on rug company ads, Alex, you know, like it was just local stuff, even the street names. We all knew them. And so it was, you would turn it on and NBC had it on at 1 a.m. And it was just like, how did this show that was written and shot and performed for me get on the air?
A lot of people didn't get it. I mean, did a lot of people outside of this country really understand it?
That's a great question. I think all over the United States, Conan O'Brien talks the same way about discovering it, or his brother was watching and say, you got to see this. And anybody in comedy got it. I just think that they did a lot of film parodies that were, you know, Martin Short was goofing on Jerry Lewis. And, you know, there was a great one I caught the other night on. Now you can watch them on TikTok or on Instagram. And it was Flaherty and Candy doing a parody of Going Down the Road, the Canadian film from the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, and then
that's pure Canadiana.
It's pure. And there's Candy and this old Firebird picking up O'Flaherty and Flaherty, and they're going to drive to Toronto where the streets are paved with gold and there's jobs for everyone. And so even though they were mocking everything, it was done with such love for these things that it was just, there was a joy to it that I think what didn't make it become cynical. And I think that's what we cherish now.
Bill Brio with us, TV critic and author, commenting on the passing of Joe Flaherty, veteran SCTVer. Bill, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
You too, Scott.
All right. I don't know. I don't know how these guys feel about this, because even me saying this makes me feel old, and I'm just a fan. Teenage Head preparing for their 50th anniversary show. It's coming up Saturday, April 6th at Carmen's. And joining us here to talk about all of this and what we can expect. And I don't know. I think it might be a typo. It might be just 40 years. Steve Mann is with us. Dave Rave, Gene Champagne, and Trent Carr on lead guitar. Of course, filling in from the Headstones. Welcome, all of you. It's great to have you here.
Thank you. Hey, Thanks for having us.
All right. So, good to hear you, Scotty.
So I understand you guys are rehearsing right now. You're in the middle of practicing. Is that right?
Yeah. Do you want us to play a song for you?
Yeah, go for it. Yeah. Actually, we were going to get you guys to come in, but we didn't think of it fast enough. We were going to get you guys to play something coming in, but you know.
Oh, okay. We can always take it out.
Yeah, we will. We'll do that. Okay. That's what we'll plan in a few minutes. Get something ready. All right. So, so tell us about that. Well, let's start with Steve. And Steve, this is 50th anniversary. When you sit there and you think 50 years, what comes to mind?
I feel very, very fortunate to still be here. Not only here, but to have a great band that is wanting to play. And, you know, I think back to when I was like 12 and 13 years old, if I could have one wish, it would be, I want to be a rock star.
Yeah.
I don't want to wish for good health or cure cancer or world peace. Rock star. So, yeah, I feel very thankful that we're still able to get out of our wheelchairs and rock it.
And what's that vibe, Steve, you get from the fans 50 years later? Although, you know, they might be feeling the same way you are.
A lot of people have their stories about what high school we played at when they went to it. And do you remember this and that? But I mean, it's a really, really great fan base. They're very loyal. They're almost like country and Western fans.
Mm.
Once you've got them, you've got them. I hope they think like that.
So, you know, Gene, obviously you've been playing with the band for a while. Trent, you're in for this and helping out. What's it like, and both of you can handle this, what's it like to come in and fill these shoes on a band that has this kind of history?
Yeah, I was a fan when I was like, this is Trent. I was a fan when I was like 14, and they were one of my favorite bands. And I didn't realize they were kind of a local band at the time. So to me, they were just like, along with the Police and the Clash, it was Teenage Head was there. And I would go see that they played in my high school. So now when I'm playing with them now, I got, you know, they called me up when Gord was not doing so great. Mm-hmm. And I was going to sort of be the second guitar player filling in. And so now that he's gone, I'm like here just being like a tribute. Every show we play, I do every solo faithfully to the record, and that's how I love to hear it, and that's how I want to play it.
Wow, you played at Trent's high school. What does that say right there? Holy smokes! So, what's it like to play those riffs, Trent? What, you know, obviously, Headstones have done pretty good for themselves as well. What's that vibe like for you? Is it a different headspace?
These songs are the songs I learned to play guitar on. Like literally, like I played Wild One was like the first guitar solo I ever learned and stuff like that. So me playing it, and I got the chance, the fortune to meet these guys back in the 90s. And we played some gigs together and hanging out with Gordon, Steve and Frankie and sitting there with Gord at the time and him showing me the guitar that's on the cover of Frantic City. I'm like just like a teenager freaking out.
You know, to be honest with you, Waver here. To be honest with you, when I'm on stage and I look to my right, I see Steve rocking, and I look back and I see Gene. And when I look to see Trent, I just feel it's a continuity of where Gordy, like the sense he's not copying Gordy, he's just continuing the message that Gordy brought to rock and roll, and in his own way, but still inspired by the spirit that Gord had. So I don't feel any change, honestly, from the old days. It's just a continuity.
There's always sort of, as Gene here, there's always sort of been a connection between all of us. I mean, I've been in the band now 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back with Gordy even before that, and Trent played Trent's played with Gord. I played with Gord prior. Gord used to come to my early band, the Killjoys. He used to go to the shows. So we've really all known each other a very, very long time. And Gordy played on Trent's record. So it's pretty family-like, I'd say.
It's funny, when I was living in New York City, I remember walking down Houston Street, and I remember looking to my left, and there was a picture of that amazing man, Hugh Dillon. And I thought, is that Frank on the wall in New York?
Yeah, yeah.
But I realized he had the same spirit, you know? So it seems so natural, right, Stevie?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was the picture for?
It was for the movie, that movie.
Dance Me Outside?
Hardcore
Logo. Oh, Hardcore Logo.
Yeah, and so I thought, there's the spirit of Frank. He, you know, so we're all, it's a family thing here. It's like, just like the city of Hamilton's our family, too.
You know, it's interesting because when members of the band pass, and this is like with any band, many say, well, can it go on? Can it do this? Can it do that? But what you're describing here and the friendships and the people that have known each other for years and followed each other's career, this is almost like a band evolving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Good point. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that sense at all?
What's that? It's a band evolving.
A band evolving. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what?
Without even knowing it.
Yeah. Like when I joined the band, it wasn't like it was a big deal. It was just Gord just said, come on down and play.
next thing you know, I was in the band. You know what I mean? And it was never really. And same with Gene. You know, we've all had to be here. It's not like we were chosen.
You know, you bring up an interesting point that we have to be here. And do you feel that loyalty to the fans? I mean, they just want this party to go on forever. I mean, they just want this experience to continue forever. Is that what's drawing you into this? What keeps this going?
Well, it's not money. Okay, there's a little fat.
Oh, man.
So, you know what? It's amazing because I know, Steve, all of us get it. You know, like we're walking down the street and somebody just reminds us of how much the band meant. You know, I remember when Gene was sick during COVID. I mean, the whole country came together to back him. You know, like it was beautiful. I remember getting emotionally touched by that because I just saw the love. Right. You know, and same with, you know, Steve, when all of us, the love is there from the people who watch the band, you know.
All right. So you guys are going to play us out. So load up, get ready. And I'll talk for a few seconds and I'll set up the show and tell you that, of course, Teenage Head, the 50th anniversary edition of is happening at Carmen's Event Center. It's happening this coming Saturday, April 6th. Teenage Head 50th anniversary homecoming party. And of course, Michael Lewis is going to open the show. They got a merch marketing and mingling thing afterwards. So there's lots of stuff going on. So get out, buy your tickets, and enjoy. Steve Mann, Dave Rabe, Gene Champagne, Trent Carr, Teenage Head celebrating their 50th anniversary. Play us out, boys.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Scott. Come on early and pick up some stuff. Steve's made some really great artwork, and we got old vintage stuff. So come on out. We're going to play some rock and roll for you guys, okay? Take care. Come on, let's do it, CHML.
What are you doing?
Yeah. So today you remember me.
There you have it, Teenage Head, and of course this Saturday night at Carmen's 50th anniversary. Last week there was an open letter from hundreds of economists, I guess it was over 300, talking about carbon tax realities, and it turns out that this is really becoming, I guess, a game of who do you believe and who is saying what. Carson Jarama is with us. Economists' open letter oblivious to carbon tax realities is the headline. Liberal policy is a top of massive subsidies and regulations, which the letter ignores. And where do you go from here? To talk more, Carson Jarama with us, comment editor with the National Post and here now. Carson, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Good to be here, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So is this turning out to which side do you believe? Who do you believe here? I mean, it's now we've got hundreds of economists lining up saying, well, look, even money people think this is a good idea. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that the idea that you have economists come out and make this letter, I mean, it's kind of like it's a bit of a stunt. Academics are so obviously critical of conservative politicians. I don't think anybody should really take that seriously. But in terms of who do you believe, I mean, I guess it depends on what are we talking about, and everyone's talking about something different. The Economist letter, for example, talks about the carbon tax. It talks about the logic of the carbon tax, but it talks about the carbon tax in isolation of, mostly in isolation of other policies. It doesn't consider other policies around for climate change. It doesn't consider explicitly, anyway, other reasons why emissions might be dropped. So one thing that the letter does mention, it says emissions dropped by such and such percent between 2019 and 2024, but that doesn't take into account how many that emissions went down during the pandemic because people were in lockdown. People just seem to be talking past each other a lot.
It seems, and the way this is put forth by government, if you're against it, you're a denier. We're slowly realizing, or are Canadians slowly realizing, the majority of Canadians are concerned about climate change. We're just not sure if this is the most effective or efficient way to go about it. Are we having that discussion yet?
I think that's a discussion most people are having. the government wants to have, I think like you suggest, the government says, if you disagree with these policy, you're denying climate change. But of course, disagreeing with the policy or approach to climate change doesn't mean you're denying that it exists or denying that humans are contributing to it. I'm certainly not denying that. But most people, when they, I think that is the question that people are having. Do you put extra tax on gas? Do you subsidize green technologies? Or do you just sort of put that all away and focus on mitigating the effects of a warmer world, right? What can we do to prepare for when the world becomes warmer? So there's a bunch of different policy approaches that we're having that should be the discussion. But as soon as you object to one policy, the response is like, well, you don't believe in climate change. Well, no, that's not, that's really too simple to look at it.
And it seems like we're having this debate on either extreme rather than a compromise or some sort of solution in the middle. The government is convinced that we don't understand it. It has not been explained well enough to us. Is it that it hasn't been explained to us, or that we don't like the message? Because again, at the end of the day, I think a lot of Canadians are asking, well, where does the money go?
Yeah, I think, the Liberals have done a poor job of selling their policy, but I don't think people are dislike it because they don't understand it.
Yeah.
You're paying more for gas and you get a rebate. I think people get that. But the point is, what you see is you're paying more for gas. Gas is going up for a whole variety of reasons. Why are you making it even more expensive? Another point that they don't recognize, and another point that doesn't get discussed as much, is when you increase the cost of gas, yes, that increases the cost for you to fill up your tank, but it also increases the cost for the truck driver who delivers groceries to the grocery store. So the prices, it sort of finds its way increasing prices on everything. The unfortunate thing for the policy is that it did sort of coincide with a period of high inflation. So people feel like things are already more expensive, and now you're making them even more expensive on top of that. And so I don't know. Economists love the idea of consumption taxes, GST. And I'm sympathetic to this view to a point, but the idea is you can see how much tax you're making. You can control it. It's transparent. It's not hidden somewhere. You see what's going on. But the point is that people see it, which is, obviously the thing that lends itself well to a visible consumption tax is the thing that also makes it unpopular.
And it's also, it seems it's less about reducing, more about changing habits where options aren't necessarily available.
Yeah. In some cases, if you've got to drive to work every day, you still have to drive to work every day, yeah. no matter what the costs are. If your home heating bill is high or is going up higher, not everybody can afford to make the necessary changes to get a more cost-effective, heat pump or that way. Electric vehicles are expensive and they don't really, and they're not as reliable as we need them to be. Yeah, you're right. Like in a lot of cases, there is not a good alternative. Like, so if beef becomes too expensive, you can switch to pork or to chicken or whatever. There's not as many options for a guy, which is, I don't mean to say there is no options. You can bike to work, you can take the bus and other things like that, but it's not as, it's not necessarily as easy.
Carson Jeremiah with us, comment editor with the National Post. Open letter from economists is oblivious to carbon tax realities. Carson, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thank you.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, today's talk.
900 CHML.
The Prime Minister on the campaign trail again. It's sort of a pre-budget charm offensive. And virtually every day there's going to be a different announcement as opposed to announcing all the budget on one day, which is coming by April 16th. By then we'll know most of it. And last week, on Thursday, they talked in Surrey, BC, how the government plans to provide more than $1 billion in low-cost loans, grants, and student loan forgiveness to expand childcare across Canada. The Prime Minister said the funding is part of the Liberal government's effort to win back support among young voters, or younger voters, and middle-class families. And to talk more about all of this, what it means, Manny Figueredo is with us, President and CEO, YMCA of Hamilton, Burlington, Brantford, and here now. Manny, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm well, Scott. Thank you.
So, Manny, your thoughts on these announcements and what it means for your organization?
Well, we're excited to hear this. Like any kind of managing complex change, the vision 2 years ago, the Canada-wide early learning program is exciting because we know the vision is the right vision. Because when we invest, $10 up front in the early years, you know, for every dollar you invest in the early years, stand corrected, you get $10 back. And there's such a demand for families and especially a woman to enter the workforce. But like any kind of change, you have to resource that vision. You have to make sure the skill is there and you have to make sure there's incentives. So it's a step in the right direction, but we still have quite a few waiting spaces. And our greatest challenge is recruitment, to be honest, to fill the current capacity. Across HBB, Hamilton, Burlington, Brantford, we have around 9,000 children on waiting lists for the early learning program or for before and after school care. So that's how great the demand is.
And so are you saying devil in the details here? We have to figure out more how this will apply to those special niche needs that you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So we think it's great news, but why I'm saying is we're trying to advocate to understand sort of the devil's in the detail, how we access these resources, what kind of money we can for new capital spaces. But I think one of the things that we're really excited about here locally is the investment in the early childhood educators. Just to give context, in Hamilton alone, mm-hmm. we have almost 2,300 spaces that are licensed, and currently only about 1,400 are enrolled. So we're still struggling to meet the current licensed space because of the recruitment. So when I see money investing in training, that's critical for early childhood educators. And we think that will make a difference in sort of recruitment and retention.
It seems that staffing is as much, if not a bigger issue than finding space.
It is at the current time. I know I'm speaking from our local community. I mean, we always want to invest in some of the capital spaces. But as you know, Scott, a lot of those capital spaces exist in schools. But just to meet our current, if we could meet our current license space, it would mean real investment in our early childhood educators. They do incredible work. And we're still waiting for some announcement from the provincial government as well. We had advocated through YMCA Canada and Ontario around a funding formula that actually reflects the true operating costs. They have responded to phase one around increasing salaries for early childhood educators, which we think is critical. The other piece is sort of resourcing some of the true costs that providers are experiencing through inflation, the cost of nutrition and food, the cost of learning resources, the cost of utilities, et cetera, go up. So as providers, we need that sort of funding formula to reflect those true costs.
Manny, is this a seamless transition? Is it cohesive? Is it the most efficient use of resources here? Or is there a better way of doing things if we just all get on the same page?
Yeah, I think the complexity of this, like any piece, is when there's multiple levels of governments and non-for-profits involved, right? Federal funds coming through provinces and through municipalities. I think there's some more efficient ways. I can tell you that the municipalities through Brantford, Hamilton, Burlington have been responding to our needs every year when we have operating shortfalls. They have been responding. And we believe that efficiency will go back up to the province and the feds. So the funding formula really reflects the true cost of what providers are experiencing. Because the vision is the right vision. It's like you said, it's the understanding how we access and adapt to the demand that's out there.
Manny Figueredo with us, President and CEO, YMCA, Hamilton, Burlington, Brantford, federal government's $1 billion loan program for expanding childcare spaces. Manny, thank you for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Good luck.
Thank you, Scott.
A quick break here. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
All right. As you may or may not be aware, because it just kind of goes on and on, the Foreign Interference Committee continues. Democracy Watch is an intervener in the ongoing inquiry into foreign interference and have submitted a list of 10 key witnesses, about 140 key questions to ask them, and has been released by Democracy Watch. Let's bring in Duff Conacher, co-founder of Democracy Watch, and here now. Duff, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, I am. Thank you. Thanks for your interest.
All right. Obviously, we don't have time for all 140 here, Duff, but what direction do you want to see this go in? What are you hoping grabs everyone's attention?
Well, of course, there are the big questions of who knew what when and what information they passed on, including the spy agencies and then the Trudeau cabinet and the panel he had of deputy ministers who serve at his pleasure, who are supposedly watching for interference and informing the public, but have a very flawed process. And beyond that, though, there's the big questions about all the loopholes in the law that, in federal laws, that make it legal in secret to interfere in Canadian politics. And that's going to be more the focus of the policy phase that's going to run through the summer and fall. But it's already been highlighted because the facts are that there's lots of questions about nomination races that occurred and other things that occurred during the elections. And those facts reveal these huge loopholes that make it legal to interfere in secret in our politics.
Are you confident you'll get the answers that you're looking for?
In terms of who knew what when?
Mm-hmm.
No, not confident about that. One reason is Trudeau cabinet is withholding documents from the inquiry. The spy agencies say they've turned over every document, and the issue is with those documents. Some of them have national security implications, and so the commission lawyers are seeing the documents in full, but are not releasing all the information to the public. But what came out from the first round of hearings a month or so ago was that the Trudeau cabinet is withholding some documents from the inquiry. They're calling it cabinet confidence documents and using that excuse, as they did in the SNC-Lavalin case, to cover up what really went on. So as long as that cover-up continues and the commission does not get those documents, I don't think we'll know the whole truth, and the Trudeau cabinet should disclose them.
How can we move forward, Duff, in another election with all of this still hanging over our heads? I mean, do you think we'll know any more by the time another election rolls around?
The final report comes December 2024 from the commission. There'll be interim reports before then on the facts of what happened in the 2019 and 2021 elections, as far as the commissioner can determine. But the inquiry, hopefully in that final report, will make really strong, comprehensive recommendations to clean up and close all of these huge loopholes, and also strengthen enforcement and penalties, which the enforcement is really weak and it's partisan and largely controlled by the ruling party cabinet. And that means that in January, when Parliament opens again, the end of January 2025, there's time between then and the end of June to pass a bill closing all the loopholes. The question is whether the Liberals will do it. The Liberals have introduced a bill addressing the elections law just recently. And it's aimed at mainly extending the opportunities to vote. But there are a few measures in there with regard to third parties and also impersonating a candidate, which is aimed at trying to make it illegal to do deep fake videos where someone is impersonating a party leader or candidate. But there's many, many more loopholes that allow for foreign interference and misinformation and disinformation. And this bill is not going to do it. So there has to be another bill. And we'll see whether the Liberals and other parties are serious about cleaning this up and making it illegal. It's currently illegal to do it in secret.
When all of this broke way back when, with the Globe and Mail and the CSIS reports and what have you, it was evident that there was interference experienced by all political parties, but it seemed to favor the Liberals and keeping them in power. How can Canadians feel confident that the governing party that's investigating this is going to do a thorough job that doesn't benefit them? I mean, where are the other political parties on this?
Well, one good thing is that the inquiry commissioner was chosen by from a short list produced by all the parties. First time it's ever been done. Should have always been done in the past, because inquiries are usually about actions of the government and the cabinet. And the cabinet obviously should not then be choosing the commissioner. So this commissioner should feel more independent, because Commissioner Hoeg was not chosen just by the Liberals. The question is whether she'll do her job. And one of the first things to do is to get these cabinet confidence, documents from the Trudeau cabinet and see what they say, because the Trudeau cabinet's likely withholding them because they contain some information that would make the cabinet look bad. So we'll see what the commission does with that. And if they don't try and get those documents, then I don't think people should have confidence that the commission's going to really trying to get to the truth of the matter, let alone interested in cleaning it up and stopping it from happening in the next election.
The Liberal Party doesn't consider nomination races to be particularly vulnerable, as you pointed out, to foreign interference, despite irregularities surrounding the 2019 nomination of candidate Han Dong. The party's national director testified on Tuesday. What is the testimony of Han Dong going to add to this? What would you ask him?
Well, today his testimony was evasive and self-contradictory and very questionable. Made himself look really bad. And the commission better call his spouse, who he says reminded him that, yes, there was a bus of international students coming from Seneca College. He said, oh, I've forgotten that. Forgot to tell the commission of inquiry until yesterday. Hmm. It's really implausible, but they have to call his spouse now, because she seemed to know that that bus that showed up at his nomination race was from full of international students from Seneca College. So the question is, how did she know that? And when did she tell him, actually? And why has he been hiding this information since? That would help get to the bottom of it. And we'll just see from that and testimony of others this afternoon and in the future from the Trudeau cabinet and Liberal Party, whether we get closer to the truth of what happened.
The ongoing inquiry into foreign interference continues. Duff Conacher with us, co-founder of Democracy Watch, who have their own questions to ask. Duff, as always, thank you for the time. Be well.
Thank you. I'll keep you updated. Take care.
Thank you. We talked about this before the holiday weekend, and that it appeared that the Prime Minister, instead of just introducing a budget on April 16th, you know, this great big giant telephone book thing, and boom, on the desk it was, and everybody's got to decode it, that every day he's going to make a major announcement, whether it's regurgitated or not, of stuff that is in the budget. So by the time the budget day rolls around on April 16th, you've already known and be aware of what is inside it. This way, he gets, you know, 16, 17, 18 days of news coverage out of something that would normally go in one day. Sounds brilliant. Will it work? Tim Powers with us, Chairman Summa Strategies, Managing Director Abacus Data, and here now. Tim, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am well, Scott. Happy belated Easter to you.
And to you too, my friend. So your thoughts on this strategy?
I guess they got to try whatever works. I mean, this is not entirely unusual, Scott. I think before the Ontario budget, you saw Doug Ford tell you a couple of things that were coming. You see it in other provinces, but I think it's less about the budget and more about the day that just passed, April 1st, and the carbon tax increase, the carbon price increase, describe it as you will. And I think Trudeau is trying to show to people that, yeah, he gets their challenges around affordability, but whether he's a credible messenger or not is still a tough one to concede. It'll take a few days or weeks to see if there's real movement. There was an There was an Annals poll out today, which may have tracked his announcement last week on renters that had the Liberals with only behind by 12 points. So, you know, that's somewhat of an improvement, but whether any of these announcements played into it, I don't know, because I haven't seen the whole sampling period.
Does this signal that there is an election coming sooner than we think? I mean, this is almost like a campaign style sort of governance at this point.
No, I don't think it signals that. I think it signals that the Liberals realize that if they want to be competitive, they got to get out there and get their feet on the field on affordability and move away from constantly being in the box of being on the wrong side of carbon tax. So I think that's what it's about, trying to gain a point here, a point there, and the long march, what they hope will be a long march back to success.
So this 16 days of another roadside distraction tour of the budget, as I like to call it, is it about actually spreading the joy over two or three weeks as opposed to unloading it all on one day? Or is this specifically designed to try to calm over that whole carbon tax thing that's obviously brewed over the last couple of days and will continue to?
Bit of both, but I think it's to try and again take the focus away from solely being carbon tax and to be on other measures that the Liberals have that they think will help you, the listener, improve your quality of life and address affordability. That's what it's about. I mean, it's almost going to be, if they keep going at this rate, they're going to have some major big announcement on April 16th to offset what they've done in the lead up to it.
It seems that the Prime Minister is backtracking on a lot of issues that he has created. A great example of this is, you know, being told for a couple of years by immigration that you got to tap the brakes on your targets. They're way too high. You're going to put extra strain on housing and healthcare and every other system, that we have. Of course, ignored that, brought in over 1 million people. And now he says, and I mean, this is a quote, whether it's temporary foreign workers or whether it's international students in particular, that we have grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. The situation needs to be brought under control. Well, that's nice, but it's his policy that got us here. This is almost like taking the tax and then saying, well, if we cut the tax, you don't get a check. Like, does he not understand that that was he that started all of this?
Well, I guess he's hoping that we don't, right?
Is that really what the plan is here, Tim? Is that he just thinks we're stupid and we don't get it?
Well, I think he's going to try and reframe the narrative in a way that he thinks suits him. And maybe he's counting on people not to be as engaged, right? There's lots of proof to suggest that sometimes people's political engagement is not significant. But when it comes to things like carbon pricing and where that came from and who brought that in, and when it comes to spending and inflationary pressures and where that came from, you may not be engaged on a daily basis, but all you have to do is a couple of clicks and you can figure out what's happened over the last 7 or 8 years when it comes to who spent what, who's done what. So maybe he's hoping people won't do that, Scott.
I understand with what you're saying in that this is a distraction because, you know, we were just had a guest on and we were talking about what he was had unveiled, I think, on Thursday. And now we're already on the Monday, Tuesday, and he's talking about a food program. So is all this going to get lost in the sauce or is that the idea?
I think he wants some of it to get lost in the sauce, right? Like, that's what they do. They throw so much out there and they focus on that you see some things and miss others. And then when we come back to the 16th, I think they'll try and turn it into one great story of what they've done for you and why they've done it and where they're going from there. So that, I think, is their storybook that they're working from.
Tim Powers, Chairman, Summa Strategies, Managing Director, Abacus Data. Always fun, Tim. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Take care, Scott. Bye.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk.
900 CHML.
As you know, the solar eclipse is coming on April 8th, and we are sort of right in the path of utopia, and so is Niagara Falls. They are expecting just a boomer of a day and visitors up over 1 million to the point where a preemptive state of emergency being called. Let's bring in Jim Diodati, mayor of Niagara Falls. He is here now. Jim, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So I remember chatting with you, Mayor, when this first came about, and like Niagara Falls in true form, you're taking advantage of this to the hilt, and you expected a lot of people. Boy, did you think you'd be calling a state of emergency before all of this arrives?
Well, no, and in fact, it's the region who called the state of emergency. A lot of people are asking why the city did. We didn't. We were a little surprised, caught a little off guard. Thursday at the end of the day, just before a long weekend, the region decided to declare a state of emergency, which, you know, a lot of the media have been joking with me now, saying, you know, isn't that saved for an emergency? Like a tornado, a derailment, a blizzard? And I said, yes. So here I've got to kind of hang in there and live with it. And I'm using it as a good opportunity to remind people that because we are expecting the biggest crowd in the city's history, at least to come prepared. Make sure your gas tank is filled, your vehicle and your devices are charged, you've got comfortable shoes, if you have medication, bring it, water, cereal bars, maybe a comfortable blanket if you want to look up at the solar eclipse. I'm using it as a chance to remind people, don't come at the last minute and expect everything to be as it normally is. It's going to be a very exceptional day. A lot of people from all over the world want to come and experience it at Niagara Falls and to come early. So I think the main reason, Scott, the region did this is, yes, Waze is going to redirect people down side streets and back roads, but it gives them potential access to provincial and federal funds, you know, for the extra police and ambulance and all the other extra personnel we're going to deploy for this event.
So were you consulted about this at all, Mayor?
No. No, I was not consulted. I found out about it after it was done in a press release, like everybody else. I was a little surprised, but again, it's done. And you know, but it's funny. It's a two-edged thing. I mean, on one hand, some people have canceled their hotel rooms because they're thinking, well, what's going on? Why is there an emergency? Is it to do with our eyes, the sun? You know, is there a problem? But on the other end, it's drawn more attention. Now it's gone international, and now we're doing, you know, interviews all over the world because of it. So it's kind of weird how it's going to play out. I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be a moth to the flame or otherwise, but I know one thing. That has caused it to get way more attention than it originally did.
You'd be thinking that you'd be the first guy they'd call to have into this conversation, but I digress. I understand where you're coming from. So that being said, it sounds like this is such an anomaly. Like, how do you prepare for it other than all hands on deck?
Well, you're exactly right. And so we've got a major U.S. documentary company that covers these, and they said you should expect 8 to 9 times the biggest event you've ever had. Our biggest event was Nyquilenda in 2012. We had around 150,000 people here at once. We had a major transportation plan. We had to close roads, add GO trains, and it was well-managed, excellent event. I liken it to swimming in 10 feet of water, which is over my head. Well, now we're going to be swimming in 100 feet of water, which is still way over my head, but we're going to use the same skill set, the same planning mechanism. We've got our emergency operations center that's been activated, and we're planning plan A, plan B, plan C. Little things that, you know, you might not think of, like making sure we're bringing in extra cellular towers so that we've got enough bandwidth for everybody that likes to send messages. And we've brought in entertainment, not to bring more people, but to get them to stay a little longer so they don't all leave at the same time right after the eclipse, so we don't have gridlock. So we've done a lot of subtle things that should have a big impact on the, you know, enjoyability of everybody's trip to Niagara Falls that day.
And how cool is it this is happening on a Monday, so you get the whole weekend out of it?
Oh, my God. And the schools have made it a professional development day, so they're off. Mm-hmm. It's a long weekend. We're getting all sorts of notoriety. It's great for the international because after COVID, we were hit extremely hard. And domestic tourism's largely returned, but international's lagging. And this takes us from the back burner to the front burner. And what really helped when National Geographic declared us the best place in the world to see this, and NASA is going to be here. We're going to have the Canadian Space Agency, Guinness Book of World Records will be here. There's going to be a lot of neat things happening, and we're making history. The last total solar eclipse in Niagara Falls was 99 years ago. The next one will be in 120 years. So this is once in a lifetime and a chance where it's totally Mother Nature. It's Mother Nature made one of the great natural wonders of the world, the falls, and of course, one of the great celestial events of the universe, this total solar eclipse at the same time, at the same place. And a lot of people are really excited about this.
It's a marriage made in heaven, that's for sure. Is everything booked? Restaurants, hotels, are you jammed? Are you seeing that?
Yeah, yes, but there's still, I was contacted by the Hotel Association. I appreciate you asking. It's a great question. And they told me there are still a good number of good rooms at reasonable rates available. So they said, there's a lot of press around, the odd hotel room that's expensive. They said, by and large, there's still lots of rooms at reasonable rates. So a lot of, whether you're coming down for the day, whether you're doing a vacation rental, whether you're traveling in a motorhome or you're going to sleep in your car, there's lots of opportunities. I can tell you the restaurants are so excited. They've got a lot of promos like Sips and Eclipse and all different meat. Oh yeah, lots of thematic ideas to have fun and play with the idea. And as I mentioned, we're going to attempt to break a Guinness World Record with the most amount of people wearing the exact same sun costume. All the hornblower boats are in the river, so a lot of people will watch the eclipse from the boat, and we're going to break the record on one of the boats. And Guinness will be here from the UK to keep an eye on it, make sure we do things right.
And of course, it's all happening in Niagara Falls. What better place? Jim Diodati with his mayor of Niagara Falls talking about the solar eclipse, April 8th. Still some rooms available, Jim. Thanks for all of this. Good luck.
Thanks, Scott. And remember, the GO train's the best way to come. They got lots of trains. See you.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Good luck. We certainly know the debate, argument, whatever that came forth out of the situation with the parking lot in Stony Creek. Some wanting it for to be kept parking. Others wanted it for affordable housing. It's amazing to me that this even got to this point and why some sort of compromise, some sort of solution wasn't found. But instead, no, we dig in our heels. We create divisiveness, and it's either this or it's that. So now Stony Creek councillors are teaming up to solve affordable housing issues in their wards. Mayor Andrea Horvath's decision to invoke strong mayor's power to force the sale of two downtown Stony Creek parking lots for affordable housing has resulted in the formation of an alliance of the three councillors who serve upper and lower Stony Creek. It's being presented as a proactive move to jointly look at, for affordable housing solutions in the community. Or is it pushback? But we see this stuff all the time in council. I don't know, I think. Peter Graff with us, professor of political science, McMaster University, here now. Peter, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm well, thanks. And you?
I'm good so far, Peter. Thanks for asking. So we often see block voting and this team representing that team and with certain votes and such in Hamilton. Your thoughts on the situation around the parking lot? Are you surprised it got to this point that some sort of solution or compromise wasn't found along the way?
Yeah, I am, I have to admit. I mean, I think it's a situation where for a lot of councillors, the idea of social housing in their ward is seen as something that's going to create unhappiness among their citizens. And so there's a desire not to vote for social housing in someone else's ward so that they don't vote for social housing in your ward. Mm. And those kinds of prit quo quos, produce a situation, where you can't have housing in a large part of the city. So in a situation like this, it is unfortunate that there wasn't some compromise. And I think in some ways it's a sign of, one of the problems of having the strong mayor's powers is that it takes away the responsibility on the part of councillors to try and find solutions. Because in a way it's easier just to do what's going to be locally popular and let the mayor pay the price of invoking strong mayor powers in some of these cases, rather than trying to find some kind of responsible compromise.
Peter, do you think this is less about the parking issue and more about the type of housing that was to go there or is to go there?
I find most people don't really go to the mat for parking spaces. Usually parking spaces are, it's similarly, you don't want, it's not just social housing. You don't want a new larger building in your neighborhood. Well, there's not going to be parking for the rest of us. There was a place near here where they were trying to add a couple of units to a house, and suddenly it was going to be parking Armageddon in the neighborhood as a result. So I think in many cases, a parking issue is a kind of a socially acceptable way of expressing one's disquiet for another part of the development.
All right. So the Stony Creek councillors working together, your thoughts on this? This isn't really uncommon, is it?
Well, I mean, I think it's not that common where we see councillors from one part of the city saying, let's create a set of solutions, specific to Stony Creek, or specific to Dundas, Ancaster, or something like that. So in this way, it is maybe a bit less common, and it's really something that, if it's a serious effort by the part of these councillors, could be really valuable in terms of trying to create, if part of the opposition in this case was that, residents didn't really want social housing in their neighborhood, in a way these councillors are trying to create a space to say, no, there's going to be, housing and social housing in all parts of the city. And if it's coming to Stony Creek, let's do it right. And can we mobilize the resources in this community to do it right or do it better than it happened this time? So if it's a serious effort to try and bring the stakeholders together and try and build community support for doing more and better housing development and affordable housing development in Stony Creek, hats off to the councillors.
How does the mayor and other councillors react to this, do you think?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, they seem to find ways to, have conflict in many ways in city council in Hamilton. But in a way, you could think that the response might be to say, great, we're taking the push to have more affordable housing in the city seriously, and maybe we should emulate this in other part of the city by getting the local councillors together and getting them to engage with, the business community and other actors to find good sites and also find ways of working together, because building affordable housing is pretty complicated in terms of the number of different actors you have to get together to get these things financed and built. And so in that context, if you have the councillors actually putting some of their own shoe leather in terms of finding local supporters, local entrepreneurs who can make this happen, it could be really positive. So, it remains to be seen, but maybe this is a model that should be emulated in other parts of the city. At the very least, I think council should be, supportive of this plan to say, yeah, we took this idea of housing crisis in our city seriously. We've got to try new initiatives to make it work.
Was enough consultation done with all parties involved here, or does that just, again, create more delay, which is obviously what we're trying to overcome?
I think you can always have more consultation, but, these lands were ultimately zoned many years ago, for uses in housing, and, here's a use in housing. I think there are ways in which, there was a door opened when it came to council last week that maybe some other options could be looked at, that there were features of this project, around things like parking or, heights of buildings and so on, that there was space to have some further discussion. But ultimately, the people who didn't, want anything ultimately prevented it from being reopened. And so, yeah, I think, the conversation could have been continued, but it seems really that the people who were opposed to housing on this particular project on council were happier just to have it go, to have their opposition registered and let the mayor overturn them. So the responsible course on this file, which I think would have been more open debate, more consultation, at least at the level of city council, was foreclosed by the decision of the councillors themselves.
So do we learn from this, Peter, or does this create more divisiveness?
Well, I think we might learn from this is that there is a kind of a push at the level of the city as a whole, and from the point of view of the mayor using her strong mayor powers in this case to make these projects go forward. So an old politics of just having, a set of councillors creating a block where they promised not to vote for housing or social housing in each other's ward as a kind of form of a mutual defense pact, it doesn't seem that politically viable anymore. And seems to also garner a degree of public criticism that we usually didn't see from that kind of voting in the past. So I think it does invite those councillors to say, yeah, other strategies have to be used. And those may include trying to get ahead of the issue, like these councillors are doing, to say, if we don't want these sites, not really imposed, but kind of chosen without our overview, well, then we'd better have some other sites that are moving and are viable that we can propose, rather than having sites imposed.
Peter Graff with us, professor of political science, McMaster University, Stony Creek councillors teaming up to solve affordable housing issues in their wards. Peter, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
And you too.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news with the Scott Radley Show. You can also read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is with us now, Scott. Hope you're doing well.
I am, Scott, I am so well that I do not have to wake up at 4 o'clock this week, as I did last week to host. I love hosting Good Morning Hamilton, but gadzooks, that 4 o'clock alarm is a pain in the butt.
Yeah, going in the shower feels like gasoline in your eyes.
Oh, I don't know. Well, I don't usually open my eyes with gasoline, so I don't know. But I don't know how Rick Zamperin does it every single day. I don't. It is a grind.
It is a tough haul, that's for sure. So this is why I think people are unhappy with our prime minister.
You whittled it down to one thing?
No, but because there's a lot of examples of this. This is out of the Global News website. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says the government wants to rein in the number of temporary immigrants coming into the country, saying the situation needs to be brought under control. He then goes on, and this is a quote, whether it's temporary foreign workers or whether it's international students in particular, that have grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. And then he gives us an example. We want to get those numbers down. It's a responsible approach to immigration that continues on our permanent residence. And then it goes on. He makes this sound as if he knows nothing about it and that he didn't create this situation. And we all know a couple of years ago, the immigration department said, you got to trim these numbers. You're going to tax the healthcare system. You're going to tax every system, whether it's shelters, whether it's healthcare, what have you. And now he didn't listen to them and he brought in over a million people. And now he's walked back these targets and capped his students and capped the temporary residents coming in. And yet says, like, I don't know how this happened. He assumes that people will hear this part of the announcement, but won't hear the part how it all started, which is him ignoring the information from the immigration department. He creates the problem and then tries to find a solution.
It makes me think of, Scott, you're the neighbor on the street who won't cut your grass and lets the weeds grow 2 feet high and everyone's furious at you. And then you call everyone and all the neighbors together and go, guess what, folks? I'm going to cut my grass. And you're expecting some sort of hero's welcome when they've been screaming at you for months because you've made a mess. I agree. It sounds like he's striving for the applause that we're solving a problem, but it's not applaudable when you're the one who created the problem. It doesn't make any sense.
It's a dishonest distraction. It's like saying, if we cut the carbon tax where we're taking money from you, you won't get the check. I mean, it's like it's a shell game. And, you know, I was watching commentary the other day and the NDP pundit said, the low information voter, and I thought, wow, that's like a nice way of saying deplorables. She just said the low information voter, meaning stupid voters. And that's exactly what he's doing here. He's trying to pretend that we don't know the rest of the story.
Well, look, can we just stop for 1 second? Because I just wanted to address what you just said, that an NDP MP made a comment about something the government is doing.
It wasn't an MP, it was a pundit, it was someone who does communications for them.
Oh, yeah, regardless, okay, they work for the... There should be a moratorium on any NDP member, MP, whatever, saying anything about anything, because it is entirely them that is propping up this government and allowing them to do this. Anyone who is aligned with the NDP until the next election should not be allowed to say anything about things that the federal Liberals are doing wrong, because they're only doing it wrong because the NDP are letting them. It would take one word, one sweep of a pen from Jagmeet Singh to say, you know what, our agreement is over. And all those things that they point to that the Liberals, they don't like that they're doing, immediately end. So like you're talking about like Trudeau saying this and him trying to fix a problem that is of his own making. Anyone who is with the NDP is in the exact same boat. They are the authors of their own misfortune if they have a problem with what anybody in the Liberal government is doing. It's ridiculous. Every time I see Jagmeet Singh get up there and say, oh, this government, someone should yell and cut him off and go, by the way, you are the guy. You are responsible. How are you pointing a finger at this and saying it's their fault when you could stop it instantly? It's just it like I do think, Scott, that when they talk about low information voters, they really do believe that we are all a bunch of drooling morons who don't see this stuff. Yeah. They have to. Otherwise, they wouldn't do these things.
What are your thoughts every day? Another budget nugget unloaded before the actual budget, this way spreading it over 2 or 3 weeks instead of one day. Is that going to work? Or are we just going to get tired of it?
You know what? It might work. It might. Again, I think, though, that the people – I think there's a lot of people, and I'm hearing this really – this is one of the first times I've heard this, because people generally, no matter who is in government, people do like getting free stuff. That's just a reality. It doesn't matter if it's conservatives giving it out or whoever. But I have, Scott, for the first time, maybe you've heard this too, I'm starting to hear people say, enough with the spending. We're broke. Stop spending. And it's, you do this enough times in the week or two leading up to this, it could backfire because people are saying, what are you doing? We need to save money. We need to not be spending anymore. We are out of money. But so we'll see. We'll see if people's natural seemingly reaction to like getting free stuff overrides what other people are saying, that we just can't afford it.
All right, Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read them in your Hamilton Spectator. Thank you, Scott. Have a great show.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. Mr. Lowe, the teacher, I never really had a problem with cell phones in my class. I had a box, the cell phone dungeon. In they went. Lunchtime, it's yours. Teaching time, mine, unless needed, in the dungeon. The grade eights respected this, and I told them, I'm the CEO of this class. Suggestions welcome to fine-tune, but your education is my responsibility. It worked great. What's the problem? Keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.